morning. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York. Welcoming you to this, first day after Christmas, actually, edition of Vantage Point on WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Dial or Pacifica Network here in New York. In collaboration with YCRadio.org, that's the York College Radio, if you will. And, of course, this is the first day of Kwanzaa. We also want to speak to that as well. Well, we hope that everybody had a pleasant Christmas Day yesterday, and everything was in good order, and everybody had a great time. We certainly did in our household. And, of course, today is the first day of Kwanzaa, the day of unity. And soon we'll be speaking to Segun Chewbacca with the Kwanzaa Coalition to talk about what's happening with Kwanzaa in relationship to that organization's programming. We're also going to be talking to Attorney Barbara Arnwine. She's going to give us a report back from the People's Democracy Conference on voter suppression in the 2016 election. We got to continue to talk about that. Her organization, Transformative Change, happened to have convened that conference, and I was honored to be one of the hearing officers and a panelist for it. And then we're going to shift topics and go to Paradise Gray, our resident sort of mentor for me on the hip-hop movement. Paradise Gray, one of the co-founders of X-Clan, has a new book out. His first book called No Half Steppin', and it's about the club scene back in the day and its contribution to hip-hop. But first of all, we just want to also send out condolences to the family of Solomon Goodrich. Solomon Goodrich, I've not seen, had not heard in a long time, actually on my mind a great deal. He made his transition last week. I was received notice from a couple of different people about that, but he had actually been on my mind. Solomon Goodrich was a stalwart, a prototypical race man in the spirit of Marcus Garvey, to be sure. He had been a member of the Congress of Racial Equality when the Congress of Racial Equality was really a relevant and meaningful organization. It's no longer that. It sort of became subverted into some kind of right-wing organization in its later iterations. But Solomon Goodrich was in back in the day when CORE was strong and vibrant and at the forefront of the Black Power movement. Well, they went from civil rights and so forth and integration, and of course then it then, you know, joined the struggle for Black Power. He also was the longtime executive director of the Roy Wilkins Park, which is really an incredible facility out in Jamaica, Queens. Well, I don't know if this is Jamaica or not, but that section of Queens, most people know what I'm referring to. And it has that incredible Spectrum Theater and whatever for many, many, many years. Very closely aligned with Betty Dobson, by the way, and Samotep. And he also served a term as chairman of the board of Board of Education for People of African Ancestry, which is headquartered at Clark House. So we just want to send out to his family and all his friends. Some of you may not know or be aware of his transition. He is our youngest ancestor and one who lived a great life in service to African people and to suffering and oppressed humanity. So Solomon Goodrich, we now salute you as our youngest ancestor. Okay, well, let's get kicking for today's program, if you will. And we want to start off by talking to Brother Segun Chewbacca, who is a really dynamic brother who does so much work. He and the NACO, the National Association of Coweed Organizations, local chapter here in New York, and with the African Festival and so many different things. Brother Segun, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you. Arigani, Brother Daniels. Brother Ron, how's it going?
Everything is going good. It's Unity Day, and so things have got to be doing real well. So we wanted to bring you on because this is the first day of Kwanzaa, and
yes,
you always do an incredible job of programming and all those good things. So I just wanted to spend some time with you this morning. First of all, the Kwanzaa Coalition, I understand, is the organization that does a lot of the major programming. Talk to us a little bit about the Kwanzaa Coalition, its origins, its mission, and et cetera.
Yes. The Kwanzaa Collective.
Collective, I'm sorry.
Based here in Brooklyn is a group of organizations, the International African Arts Festival, NACO, Roots Revisited. It's really under the leadership right now of Brother Michael Hooper and Brother Wakili, and we coordinate our Kwanzaa events. So they, you know, we're on the same page. We support each other's events. We put out a joint literature, and we try to support each other's events during the Kwanzaa season. And the collective meets pretty much almost all year round, or a significant amount of months out of the year to plan events. Also, Sarasota is in the collective this year. Sometimes the membership changes slightly, but those are some of the main groups of the Kwanzaa Collectives. And their event is actually the 28th, the day after NACO's event with Dr. Karenga.
We're going to go over the schedule. I just want to, first of all, just get out the collective and the idea that this is a operational unity exercise, that different organizations come together and work collectively to sort of move it forward.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm sorry. Actually, their event is on the 29th. But it's operational unity in practice, unity without uniformity, unity and diversity.
Right. Okay, so now this year's programming, would you, and I'll do this at the beginning and also at the end of the interview, walk us through the schedule.
Okay, I'm sorry, but I don't have all of that with me because I've given out all my flyers. So I can tell you the main event for the collective is the 29th this Thursday, the 29th of December. But let me go with NACO's event because that's the 28th. And that's at Junior High School 258, 141 Macon Street, between Marcy and Tompkins Avenues, right here in Bed-Stuy, two blocks from Restoration and two blocks from the A train or the C train stop on Nostrand Avenue. We'll start at 4:30. We'll open up for vendors, shopping, food. People can come straight from work. We have a main caterer there serving food. We have a program beginning with Patsy Grant and Chuck Fowler with High Energy, a very dynamic jazz vocalist, and her trio, or quartet. And then Dr. Karenga will be speaking from 6:30 to 7:30. From 6:30 to 7:30, Dr. Karenga will be speaking because after our event, he'll be going up to Reverend Sharpton's House of Justice, National Action Network, where he'll be speaking about 8:30. And then from 7:30 to 8:30, the Asasa Ya African-American Dance Theater will be performing. So that's the schedule for NACO on the 28th. On the 29th, the Kwanzaa Collective will start at 12, and they'll go through to 8. And their event is at Junior High School 35 on Macon and Lewis. I'm sorry, that's a public school, 35. Okay, and they will be having children's programming early in the day and then adult programming later in the evening, going till 8 o'clock.
Okay, so the idea is, though, that during the course of these 7 days, there is a program every day, is there?
No, not with us, but there are many groups doing programming throughout the week. So you can find a lot of programming, but there's not that many organizations that are able to do that all every day. but there are events happening during the week. And as far as sets of event is later in the week, but I don't have the exact time on it.
Is there a website that people can go to and see the Kwanzaa Collective's scheduled events?
Yes, they can go to festival's website. We'll put it up there today. We'll try to get it up today, so we'll have the schedule. Okay, it's not up as of right now, but we will. We can post that on festival's website, which is www.iaafestival.org. www.iaafestival.org.
Okay,
we'll get that up there today.
All right, well, let's also now for our listening audience do what I call a Kwanzaa 101, because a lot of times people take for granted, because we know Kwanzaa and we do Kwanzaa, that means I'm including myself in this prospect, that everybody kind of knows all of this. So I don't want to take that for granted. And even if so, it's good to reemphasize, as Dr. Karenga does every year, sort of the meaning, the vision, mission, and meaning of Kwanzaa. And if I, am I correct in saying this is the 50th anniversary of Kwanzaa, or the 51st?
The 50th.
50th anniversary.
Kwanzaa started in 1966. The US organization started in 1965, and Kwanzaa began a year later. Dr.
Right.
Karenga created Kwanzaa out of Kawaida philosophy. And Kwanzaa is a celebration of family, community, and culture. And it was the organizations, and later on, organizations like CIFUN under Mary Baraka, Ahidi Yanda under Kalama Yasalam, Hakeem Madhubuti's organization in Chicago, and of course here in Brooklyn, New York, we had the East Cultural and Educational Center. These organizations adopted the Kawaida philosophy, and we began to spread, along with the US organization, Kwanzaa and the Nguzo Saba. Kwanzaa is the way that we try to get the Nguzo Saba into the masses of our people so they can practice it, and also introduce them to the philosophy it comes from, Kawaida, which is one of the major and most sustaining philosophies from the Black Power movement.
These various organizations were involved, but I was out in Youngstown, Ohio.
Yes, sir.
Organization called Freedom Incorporated. And when we first heard about it, because it was the era of Black Power and there was excitement about Black Power, and we first didn't quite grasp it, actually, the first year. We thought it was Black Christmas, we called it. You know, we didn't know all the details.
Yeah.
But that's all. But we wanted really an alternative to the what I call now Xmas, the sort of corrupt, commercialized version of Christmas, where people do all the spending, and you know, people pay for what they want, beg for what they need, people going into all this debt and things of those nature. So we, the first time around, I think we called it a Black Christmas celebration, you know, and we didn't have all the details. We turned out 400 or 500 people, but we gradually then came to understand the real significance and the real meaning. And I checked just the other day out in Youngstown, Ohio, and there tonight, you know, they're having the first Kwanzaa meeting. And for many years in Youngstown, we actually did have, as an organization, Freedom Incorporated, we would do 7 nights of Kwanzaa. And then we began to break it up and let other organizations take pieces, just like you're talking about here. But I've said that Kwanzaa is one of the great triumphs, really, of the nationalist Pan-Africanist movement, in that it really took that the base organizations that you talked about, but there were many, many organizations who picked it up, you know, all across the country, learned about it, and then organized and mobilized to give it the kind of popular support that it now has.
Yes, appreciate what you said, Brother Ron, if I understand correctly. And I can't remember, you know, I'm talking right here, but you know, we had numerous organizations under CAP, under CIFUN, and later on under the ALSC, which was a broader structure, but mainly CB, Council of Independent Black Institutions, and CAP, Congress of African People, which use extensively Kawaiten and Guzo Saba. And your organization in Youngstown, I mean, dozens of organizations that were working together nationally and building independent schools, cultural centers, and organizing our people around freedom, justice, equality, self-determination, free in Africa. You know, we were doing a lot of important work. And the Kawaita institutions, as far as my studies have shown, were the ones that really had stronger structures because we had institutional bases. We didn't just have organizations. We had institutions that were serving the people all week long. You know, we were educating the children. And so it's very, very significant history that we, I think, have slept as a community, and we need to reawaken around these institutions. And so Kwanzaa came out of a very, very important era, and as you said, it's one of the most, probably the most enduring aspect. This idea of culture and history is probably the most enduring aspect of our achievements of that era.
Right. Now, continuing this Kwanzaa 101 piece that I wanted to talk about, you talked about Kawaita as the foundation, the doctrine of tradition and reason, which I find very compelling in its the way it's assessed and it's laid out. Because what it basically says is that Dr. Jeffries would say the African mind, the African worldview has always guided us, and there are particular practices that were part of the traditional way of life of African people. So what Dr. Karinga did was to extract or extrapolate from these practices, the principles behind them, and to update them, because some of the things may not be practicable or even practical for today, but the principles, those seven principles, you know, are the key aspects of them. So quickly, run us through the seven principles during this 101 for Kwanzaa.
Yes, sir. Of course, the first principle is umoja, unity. Second principle is kujichagulia, self-determination. Third principle is ujima, collective work and responsibility. The fourth principle is ujamaa, cooperative economics. Fifth principle is nia, purpose. Sixth principle is kuumba, creativity. And the seventh principle is imani, faith.
Now, again, these, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So what is unity? And we say that, you know, people can use these principles and create from the base. But first, we should say what they are and give the initial meanings that Dr. Karinga gave us. So umoja is to strive for and maintain unity in the family, community, nation, and race. And we talk about peaceful and harmonious unity. So kujichagulia, self-determination, to define ourselves, name ourselves, create for ourselves, and speak for ourselves. Ujima, collective work and responsibility, to build and maintain our community together and make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together. Ujamaa, cooperative economics, to build and maintain our own stores, shops, and other businesses and to profit from them together. Nia, purpose, to make it our collective vocation, the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness. Kuumba, to do always as much as we can in the way that we can in order to leave our community more beautiful and beneficial than we inherited it. And imani, faith, to believe with all our heart in our people, our parents, our teachers, our leaders, and the righteousness and victory of our cause. And we say that if black people could practice some of these principles some of the time, a whole new change can come in their lives. And
that in order, these principles are the moral minimum that black people need, the moral minimum that black people need in order to rescue and reconstruct their history and humanity.
All right. Okay. Now, continuing, there's a, like tonight, there'll be a, you know, public celebrations and whatever, but there are also like private celebrations that take place as well. And so, and they're the symbols, and all the symbols have meaning as well for those who would practice at home and so forth. So again, we're doing this Kwanzaa 101.
Yes,
so talk
sir.
To us about the symbols, the decor, and whatever that one sees during Kwanzaa.
Okay. If you were to go to a Kwanzaa event, you'll see the what we call the Kwanzaa setup, and the symbols are the mazal, which is the crop. And this comes from the fact that the Kwanzaa takes its origin from the first fruit festivals of Africa. Kwanzaa means first. Dr. Karenga added an extra A, and the early members of the organization, they put an extra A on it for two reasons. One, there were seven kids in the organization, and they wanted each of them to participate in this Kwanzaa celebration. This is the first Kwanzaa. And so they added an A to give those children each an opportunity to participate. And then they added the extra A to distinguish Kwanzaa from the word first in Swahili. Okay, so the Kwanzaa, the language we use for Kwanzaa is Swahili, the East African, Pan-African language of Swahili. It's spoken in close to 10 to 12 nations. And so we use Kwanzaa because it's Pan-African. I myself studied Kwanzaa in high school and in college. So it was the language that the Black Power movement under Dr. Karenga particularly offered to the movement as a as the language that we should study, because we're talking about unity, the first principle. And how can we not be able to talk to each other? So we have to think futuristically in terms of this language. And so we use Swahili, and that was the primary language of the movement. So Kwanzaa is
yeah, we were talking
combat.
About the crops, and then...
Yeah, the crops.
Right.
So from after the crops, you have the Mkeka, which is the foundation. That's our history and culture. So that is, you put the foundation, and you put the crops, and then you have the kinata, the candle holder. That represents our
parent.
Well,
let's go back to the Mkeka for a minute. The Mkeka is the mat, right?
It's the mat. Mkeka is the mat.
Okay.
The kinata is the candle holder, and it represents African people and our parent organization, or parent people, I should say. Okay? African people. And I'm going to go through them, then I'm going to come back to the kinata because it's very significant in terms of the Mushuma Saba. But after the kinata, the candle holder, you have the Muhindi, and they represent our children symbolically, but they also represent regeneration, you know, and us in the afterlife, which we live through our children. Mushuma Saba is the seven candles representing each of the seven principles. And you have three red candles, one black candle, and then three green candles. Now, the black candle we put in the middle, and that's lit first, because we say that without the people, there's no struggle, which is represented by the red candles, and there's no progress, which is represented by the green candles. So we alternate when we light the candles. First is the red. Then it's the green, then it's the black. Then it's the red, then it's the green, then it's the red, then the last candle on Imani is the green that's lit on the seventh day. But also, very quickly, the candles are in the candle holder because we talk about putting the values in the people. Remember, the Kinata represents African people. And so we're trying to symbolically say that black people, we want to like these values. We want these values to be lit and represented inside of African people so they can live freer and fuller lives. And we have the Kikombi Cha Umoja, which is the unity cup. And of course, that's where historically everyone would drink from that cup. But now, because of large groups, also people concerned with health, etc., you know, we might have several symbols of unity cups around. And then there's the Zawadi, the gifts. We don't emphasize gift giving. You just talked about that. So it's not, we're not trying to duplicate Christmas in that sense. But for the children, we say that any gifts should include, first and foremost, a book and a culture symbol, book for knowledge, the importance of knowledge, and stressing that to our children, and culture symbol to stress their education. And there's symbolic, I'm sorry, supplemental symbols, which is the bandera, the flag, which for Kwanzaa we have put in as black, red, and green. We know God gave us red, black, and green. But we use black, red, and green because we say black people first, in struggle, making progress. And, of course, with that is the Nguzo Saba poster to have that as another supplemental symbol. So you have seven major symbols and then two supplemental symbols.
And during the private celebrations, I guess, as I recall it, you know, the idea is every day to light a candle and families to discuss with their among themselves and also with the children the meaning of the principle for that day. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. That's the idea. That's the concept. And sometimes they are smaller community groups, families, or people meeting in homes that might use the children to light and discuss the candle. Sometimes I just did a program in Florida at a senior residence complex, and of course each of the elders talked about each of the principles and what it means. So there's different ways you could do combinations. So there's different ways. The main thing is that people are in gathering, which is one of the first concepts around Kwanzaa, because Kwanzaa has two origins. It has the origin, the ancient origins, which is in gathering of people, reference for the Creator and creation, commemoration of the past, recommitment to our highest values, and celebration of the good. These are the early origins of first fruit festivals, going all the way back to ancient Kemet. And then you have the modern origins, which is comes out of the Black Freedom Movement. And we say that the Black Freedom Movement has two aspects to it, primarily. First, you have the civil rights, and then you have the Black Power Movement. And during the Black Power Movement, we focused on African consciousness and culture, social justice, self-determination, cooperative practices, and struggle. So these are some of the aspects of the Black Freedom and Black Power Movement that Kwanzaa developed out of.
Right. Okay, well, Dr. Segun Shabaka, we appreciate so much you spending time with us this morning. We wanted to make everybody aware that this is the first day of Kwanzaa and Umoja, and that there is a Kwanzaa collective, and to talk about its schedule. And again, you're saying that later on today, the schedule for the Kwanzaa Collective will be on what website?
www.iaafestival.org.
Okay. All right. We appreciate you being with us today. We know that the Kwanzaa celebrations are going to be powerful and strong, and that we're going to have a productive and resilient and resistance-filled new year, because in the age of the orange man, we're going to need that.
Yes, we're going to need to practice the Nguza Saba more than we have been in the last decade or two, for sure. We're going to have to really step up and come together as a community and make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems, because we're going to be dumped on with a lot of garbage, because that's what's represented here.
Right. Okay. Well, look, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Santi.
All right. Okay. Coming up next will be Attorney Barbara Arnwine, and we're going to begin to talk about what happened in the recent election, particularly in terms of voter suppression. Talk about her organization, what she's doing, and we're going to do that after we take this brief pause. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Let's deal with the real issues, that the rich are getting richer, that we are moving toward an oligarchic form of society where a handful of billionaires control the economy as a result of Citizens United, control to a significant degree our political system, and, may I say, control our media.
But they don't control WBAI. We do. Become a WBAI buddy, a monthly sustainer to WBAI. Go to give2wbai.org and help strengthen independent, listener-sponsored, non-corporate WBAI in New York. And thank you.
T-minus 10 seconds. Counting.
What a sad situation.
Lift off.
2016.
It was the best of times.
2016 World Champions, Cleveland, Ohio.
It was the worst of times.
North Carolina is one of the top races to watch in this election.
Hey, everybody, get off the street! Donald Trump wins. Get off the street!
Winter is coming.
The war is coming to an end!
Wherever we looked, the world was changing so fast that nothing of importance seemed to be happening.
Come with me.
The bus to the underworld.
Tune in for a shortcut.
2016.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
11 p.m. New Year's Eve, right here on WBAI FM.
Wait for the history.
And it's a little bit sad.
Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys.
There's a war.
Building Bridges, your community and labor report. From your workplace to your neighborhood, listen to the show that brings it all together. Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Bringing you news and analysis, local, national, and international. Monday nights, 7 p.m. We build bridges.
Okay, we're back, and again, we wanted to begin the show making everybody aware that today is the first day of Kwanzaa. We don't want to forget that. It's important to continue to lay that out. There's a way in which, and by the way, there's a Kwanzaa stamp out now, too. You go to the U.S. Post Office, and you can get a Kwanzaa stamp, which really speaks to the power of this African-American holiday that the U.S. Post Office actually, you know, had a ceremony, adopted it. You can get a Kwanzaa stamp. There's always a risk with that, because then sometimes it becomes very popularized and then it loses its potency to some degree. But our mission really is to keep it strong, and particularly in this era now. It's always important, but right now, repeating those values and living by those values is an important thing. So we're delighted that Brother Segun Sabaka could join us to talk about the Kwanzaa celebrations that are being taken, that will be taking place under the leadership of the Kwanzaa Collective. And there are many, many, many celebrations that will be taking place throughout the greater New York area and, of course, all across the country. We're delighted to be joined now by Attorney Barbara Arnwine. She is the president of the Transformative Change Coalition and a longtime friend, and we hope that she's going to make many appearances here on Vantage Point, and she has her own show. We're going to talk about all of that. She's one of the most dynamic, energetic, visionary people I know. Barbara Arnwine, welcome to Vantage Point.
Well, thank you, and happy Kwanzaa to you, Ron.
Oh, same to you, same to you. Well, first of all, I just want to do a little background introducing you to our WBA audience, at least by way of my show, Vantage Point, here. And, of course, I know you from many, many years ago when first, really, you were working with Baba Leonard Dunstan coming out of the great state of North Carolina with the working with the National Black Independent Political Party back in those days and whatnot, and then you went on from there to do many, many, many things. But among other things, in fact, you rose to the leadership, really, of the National Black Independent Political Party, playing a leadership role. But also then going on to the Lawyers Committee, where you served at many, many years there. I was at the Center for Constitutional Rights for some of that time. So just give us a little bit of background. Were you born in North Carolina, or did you go to North Carolina? I never really knew that part of your background.
I am a native-born Californian.
Oh, my goodness.
My mom was from North. My mom was born and raised in Louisiana. My dad was raised in Texas. And they migrated separately to California and met. And I was one of their 8 children that they had together. And I had a total family of 12. Brothers and sisters, and we always were raised in California. I was born in Long Beach and lived in Southern California, and then we migrated up to Northern California and lived in Oakland for a couple of years and came back to South Central, lived in Watts, and then, you know, was raised in, Echo Park, Silver Lake area, and went to Scripps College for Women at the Claremont Colleges in California, and eventually came to the East Coast via Duke University for law school.
Uh-huh. Okay, right. I never see that. That's why I always ask people about their background, because as long as I've known you, I just know you're a bad sister. I didn't know all the background stuff. Now, were your mother and father active in the civil rights movement?
That's interesting. My dad was a labor unionist. So I grew up knowing, a lot about, the labor fight, because he was very active in the labor movement, and he was a construction worker. And so he built freeways. And in fact, the reason why we went up to the Bay Area was that he was working on the Oakland Bay Bridge. For some of his retrofitting. And my father, always took great pride, in showing me all the different highways and bridges and other places that he was involved in the construction of. So he was, that was his background, but he was not into the civil rights movement. My mom was a civil rights movement person. And in fact, my whole birth was a civil rights protest. She waited until she was in deep labor when she was having me and finally called an ambulance that forced them to take her to the White Hospital, which was not that far from where she lived, but they had repeatedly, for her first 3 births, taken her to the Black Hospital, which was quite a distance away. And she thought that was, discriminatory and was pissed off and decided that I would be her barrier breaker. And sure enough, they took her to the White Hospital because it was the nearest and she was in such deep labor. And the nurses said, no, we can't admit her. She can't come here. And the doctor looked at my mom and said, oh, no, no, no. She's going to have a baby right now. We got to deliver her. So I was the first black child born in in that hospital at that time. And because I was born there, they had to give us, you know, what you call well baby treatment. So I was a continual force in the process of integrating Seaside Hospital.
Oh, that is really, really amazing. No wonder you got so much power, so much strength. See, now I'm getting the idea.
My mom, you got to give her a lot of credit. She said, I'm going to use my one power and that I have in this fight in a unique way. And she was always, you know, someone who spoke of racial equality, you know, who really promoted that idea. She was a domestic worker, you know, worked for rich people in their homes, cleaning them up. And I always heard about the injustices of that. So she taught me a lot. Like you said, I didn't have much of a choice, did I, Ron?
You didn't. Well, you had a choice about what you could do occupationally, though. You went to Duke University Law School.
Yes.
You went on to become the executive director of the Lawyers Committee, which meant that you decided to do what we call people's law or public interest law. So you obviously decided not to go into corporate law and all those things. You kind of made a sacrifice and decided to do something different. What motivated you to do that?
Well, I think God just guided my path, right? You know, when I was in college, I was determined to be a professor. I wanted to teach. I desperately wanted to teach, you know, at the high school level. And that was my, you know, focus. And I had actually applied to go to Brown University to become a professor, you know, at Brown, do my American studies, history, literature studies. And unfortunately, I was really on my way to doing that, or I also had applied to Wharton to study, business administration. So I had those two really strong backgrounds going on. And then I met a lawyer who was there to settle a huge contractual dispute between all seven of the Claremont colleges. And as a process, he hired me to be his intern, and I discovered something I never knew, civil law. I had, you know, barely knew about criminal law, basically from watching it on TV and a few family skirmishes, but I discovered civil law and contractual law, and I realized that, you know, that this was something I was very fascinated with, and he told me, he said, you got a propensity for this. You need to considered law school, and that's really what happened. And I applied the last day possible to take the October exam, and I showed up. I was one of five women, period, black, white, any color, who took that exam from Scripps. There were less than 10 of us who, from all the five Claremont colleges, who showed up to take the LSAT, and I knew nothing. So that means, Ron, I did no prep. I had no prep book. I took no prep course. I knew nothing about preparing to take an exam. I had done pretty well on my GRE, so I took the LSAT straight up. And I was the only Scripps College graduate who left Scripps and went directly into law school.
Oh, my goodness. Like I say, you're a bad sister.
No. God guided my path told me that I wanted to help people who were poor. And one thing that I'm very proud of is when I came out of law school, I went into legal services. And my whole service for the first 6 years of my life was helping people who were of low income to have equal rights and fight for their fair housing, fight for their custodial rights, fight for their employment rights, fight against, you know, unfair military discharges, fight for people who were imprisoned wrongfully and were suffering bad conditions. I am so grateful that I had that as my foundation of legal practice.
Right. Well, one of the things that happened along the way, without question, in this period with the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, but even before that,
wow,
you became the unparalleled champion for voter protection. I mean, there are many, many organizations involved in it. I'm not trying to in any way undercut their roles or anything, but it's always been a cooperative effort. But Barbara Arnwine, attorney Barbara Arnwine, was the voice really at the forefront. I mean, screaming out, but not only screaming out, but doing the work and reporting and dispatching people and whatever around this issue of voter suppression. And now, of course, having served a distinguished tenure, and a part of that distinction was your work around voter suppression at the Lawyers Committee, you've gone on now to create an organization called, what is the name?
Transformative Justice Coalition, yes.
All right.
Well, Ron, you know, first of all, thank you. I mean, I learned so much about leadership and organizing from watching you. And I think the first time I might have seen you was in Gary for, you know, the convention there. I was such a little brat at that point. I don't even think I was 16 years old when I went to Gary at the Gary convention in 72. And I remember just being struck by, you know, all the leaders. And then when you called for the National Black Independent, you know, political party convention, you know, I was really, really honored to, you know, to meet you and to watch your leadership style, which was inclusive, which at that point was really advanced because you believed in women, black women in the leadership.
Right.
You know, the only other formation really that had done that was the Black Panther Party. You were just, you know, really unique in that aspect. And I think, in fact, you were more equal than the Panther Party because it was very sincere about, you know, black women's intellectual policy and strategic leadership. And I came to really respect you and your national consensus building style. So you taught me a lot. You know, without that, I don't think I could ever have done the kind of legal advocacy, the legal justice, you know, fight. So I have a lot to thank you for.
Well, we appreciate that. And so, again, you created a new organization now, and just give us a quickie on that. Give me the title. I'll make sure I didn't, because I may not have spoken correctly.
Yes, the Transformative Justice Coalition is 18 months old. I can't believe it. Every time I say it, I just shake my head. We have been on a run, a tear, ever since we were created, you know, working on voting rights matters. You know, my real focus, as you said, is fighting voter suppression. In 2011, my son and I, you know, combined together to create what was called the Map of Shame that started exposing to the nation the issue of voter suppression. Because at that point, the nation, you know, people thought it was all conspiracy theory. But when I put together the Map of Shame and showed what all these states were doing to restrict voter rights, it changed the discussion totally throughout the country. And, you know, and I did, I think, Ron, and 2 years, I did over 200 conventions, speeches, outreach, reaching thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of activists to, you know, train people in the fact that we were approaching a new era of voting, of voter suppression. And I warned that in an election where it would be tight, that voter suppression would make all the difference. And that's what 2016 was, right? And that's
right.
What we saw. So, you know, sadly, you know, I hate to, you know, be a Cassandra in this movement, but sadly, it took that kind of tragedy now for people to really understand how deeply entrenched, voter suppression is, and how deeply critical it is, profoundly critical to our future.
Well, and I had the honor I don't know whether honor is the right word. I was delighted to be a part of it. And I only say because of the tragedy that took place and travesty in this election.
Exactly.
You immediately convened a People's Democracy Conference.
Yes.
That was just completed, which is powerful, a very, very powerful conference. I was on the a hearing officer, but also had an opportunity to share some ideas and a few remarks. In fact, I have an article that is coming out today, which is entitled Elections Matter. What is it called? Trump will be Reagan on steroids. And you may recall me making that remark during the course of, and it comes from the remarks from your board president, who was given testimony about what happened in North Carolina. And she said, among other things, elections matter. So I'm taking off. In fact, I cite her in my essay, which I'm going to send to you. Yes, yes. But anyway, tell us about the People's Democracy conference that was held. Share with us, to our listening audience, who already hear some of this, because Greg Palance is certainly one of the regulars here.
Yeah.
But it was just astounding what we heard in terms of Michigan and Wisconsin and North Carolina.
Yeah.
It just absolutely astounding, some of the testimony that came out.
Well, I am so blessed that one of the things that I've been able to do in 2016 is to combine with Ben Potastic and some others, Joel Siegel and others, and create what's called the Voting Rights Alliance. And the Voting Rights Alliance is now an alliance of over 20 organizations, including Color of Change, Moms Rising, a whole lot of great organizations that people know. And what we do is that we advocate, for voting rights, fairness for racial justice and voting. So it's a really, strong coalition. And what we did was, after the election, we said, well, wait a minute. We can't sit around and wait until January during the inauguration to protest. That we can't just protest. We got to strategize. So we put together the People's Democracy Conference to be held in December. And frankly, it was the only December conference that was being held to, address these kinds of issues. We know that people are depressed, people are upset, people are lost, don't know what to do in this time, and we wanted to give some direction and give some energy into our movement to say, this is not just about, our street action, which is critical, but it's also about our strategic action to win in 2017, because there will be elections in November, and to win in 2018, that this is the work we got to do now, not sitting around, worrying about every stupid tweet that, Donald Trump may put out, but instead to be very focused about how we're going to win. How do we train our troops? How do we do the work? How do we beat back, more voter restrictions? As we're talking right now, four states are in the process of trying to pass worse voter laws, not better. So it is critical to us that we, come together. And I was so grateful that you were able to be part of the, about 25, top speakers that we had, and you were one of only the, six, hearing officers who were able to really participate, and you brought great leadership and thought and energy to that discussion. So it was fabulous, and I plan to have another one. Probably in March or April, to do nothing but talk, strategy moving forth. We did some education at this last one, but the next one we will continue to educate, but we will focus a lot stronger on our strategic strategies.
Right. Well, it was a very, very powerful conference. It was very timely. And to hear, what's going on, but
yes,
to hear it is when people who experienced it in these various states, Michigan, I forgot Michigan as well, Reverend Bullock testified out of Michigan, to actually hear it.
Out of Wisconsin.
And how widespread it is.
Yes.
And the degree to which this is not being covered by the capitalist mainstream media.
There is no fourth estate.
Yeah, it's just, but that's why we can cover it here on WBAI and
yes,
through other medium. And in fact, talk to us about your radio show, because you have a powerful radio show too. Talk to us about that.
Well, one of the blessings of 2015 was I started what's called Igniting Change. That's my weekly radio show, everybody. It is on Tuesdays live from 12 until 1. You can hear us by going to BarbaraArnwine.com. You can hear me anywhere in the world. And we podcast all our shows. And tomorrow, I'm blessed to have the Reverend William Barber. Dr. William Barber, who is the head of Moral Mondays in North Carolina, and he's going to be talking about a special watch party, a watch service is what I should call it, a watch service that's going to be held at Metropolitan AME on this coming Saturday to welcome the new year with strategic and devoted and concentrated action. So he's going to be talking about our political action, our, you know, work that we must do. And this watch service is not your usual watch service. It is a political watch service. So I hope people will come, Metropolitan AME. So, and listen to me on Igniting Change every Tuesday from 12 to 1 Eastern Time. It is a great show. It is part of the fight for justice. It is the reason why we exist.
Right, and this will be Metropolitan AME Church in Washington, D.C., right?
That's correct, Washington, D.C.
Yeah, right, that's a great church, and we've done a lot of events there.
Yes, Dr. Forbes.
And we intend to do some more there
as
well. Yes,
and Reverend Tracy Blackman will be there and others, so it's a really important event. I hope people will be part of this night service, which is something that African Americans created that tradition of welcoming in the new year.
Right. And Reverend William Barber is really such a incredible leader. He is just so powerful, so strong. And, of course, the Moral Monday movement among the most powerful movements in this country and in the world. I mean, taking on this monster in North Carolina, where you have a situation where the governor, the Democratic governor, wins, and then the Republican House and Senate change the rules and try to nullify him. Oh my God, this is what we're in for.
People don't believe in democracy. They want an oligarchy. People got to understand that these people have no belief, no support for a democratic system. They believe in an oligarchy, that which is basically when you have government by the rich and government by, capitalist forces in our country. And that's all they want. And they will do anything they can to restrict the electorate, to make it smaller, so fewer people are voting. These people are dangerous. They're anti-democracy forces, and we got to really unite if we think we're going to win. Can't win in the bed, folks. Can't win trying to divert your attention. Got to get out there and get involved. And right. You can follow me on Twitter at Barbs73. That's Barbs73. You can also, look us up on my website, which is tjcoalition.org, and we are very active. So I hope that people will unite with us, Ron. And I know that you and I will always stay, united. Thank you for your incredible, incredible leadership.
Yeah, well, we're going to do that because the principle by which we function in the IBW, which is how we've tried to function historically, is inclusiveness, is collaboration. We don't need to take the lead by IBW in this area of voter suppression, because you are heading up and are part of a core of organizations doing that work. And this is one of the things I've been trying to advocate, is specialization and division of labor. So our responsibility in IBW is to support you. We don't have to start anything new because because there's a whole group of people who are expert, who know this, who know how to do it, who can inform us. And so that's how we have to kind of divide up the labor in the black community. So everybody does their specialty. We complement each other. We collaborate. And we are therefore stronger because of that kind of collaboration. So that's what I believe in firmly and strongly. So I was so honored to be able to come and be there and be
a part
of it. And you can count on our support moving forward.
Well, thank you, and I can't wait to, you know, continue this fight, because it's critical, people. We must, you know, unite. We must resist. We can't sit back. We got to resist this Trump administration with everything we have, because it's nothing but white supremacists. It's nothing but an oligarchy. We got to fight it.
All right. Well, Barbara Arnwine, thank you so much for being with us. Your new organization, the Voter Alliance,
the Transformative Justice Coalition,
and the Igniting Voting Rights Change Alliance. Because if anybody can ignite change, it's you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Okay, Sister Attorney Barbara Arnwine, and again, I've known her for many, many years, but when I do these interviews, I always do background, because frankly, as long as I've worked with Barbara Arnwine, I didn't know the California connection, the Watts connection, how she was born in protests and all that. And I hope this is the kind of, I like these revelations because we share that kind of information with our audience. We're going to take a break right now. Come back. Paradise Gray is going to join us to talk about his new book came out called, I think it's called Ain't No Half Stepping or something like that. Anyway, we'll be right back with Paradise Gray in a couple of minutes.
Hey, this is Shaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
This is the theme music for Cat Radio Cafe.
Oh, yeah.
A salon of the arts.
Uh-huh.
Mondays at 2 p.m. I'm Janet Coleman, the host.
And I'm David Dozer.
The displaced playwright.
Announcing
Cat Radio Cafe.
Cat Radio Cafe, featuring great interviews with scintillating authors and provocative artistes.
Or vice versa.
I see you, Cat.
Hey.
Stop clawing the furniture. Head for the radio.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Mondays at 2 p.m. here on WBAI.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
If it's brewed with fish.
People are already comparing the upcoming Trump era to the 50s McCarthy era. On the next episode of Ken Gayle's Ecologic will be a discussion with people who were there. The 50s had the communist blacklist and attack on unions, but it also had Ban the Bomb and civil rights marches and the flourishing of political folk music. Join Corinne Willinger of the Raging Grannies, Viney Burroughs of the Granny Peace Brigade, and other elders who lived through the McCarthy era. Tuesday, January 3rd at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Thanks to you.
Thank you for thinking of me.
And I thank you.
I thank you.
Let's say thank you to all you people out there.
I want to thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
All right, we're back. Again, this is the professor, and this is the first day of Kwanzaa. Everybody, we hope, had a pleasant Christmas. It's a great holiday season. It's also, for me, always a time for thought and reflection. You know, we need a relief, really, from white supremacy and from oppression and all the tensions of living in this society. And that's great, but we also need time for reflection in terms of what we're going to do to move forward. And so that's why, again, Kwanzaa is important. It's an opportunity for us to think and to look at these principles and these values. And so we just want to remind, again, people that this is the first day of Kwanzaa, unity, umoja. And, of course, we had someone on talking about the seven principles. And then Attorney Barbara Arnwine, I hope you will agree, she is a phenomenal woman. She is absolutely incredible, and she's fighting around this issue of voter suppression, and you can count on her to be on the forefront, and we're going to need that protection moving into the future. Now we turn our attention to our resident, at least my resident mentor on hip-hop, all things hip-hop, because I'm not of the hip-hop generation per se. I'm old school. I guess I'm the soul generation. I don't know what you would call me, but I appreciate hip-hop. But it's just not my generation. So I turned to this brother to mentor me and to share ideas and let me know what I don't know and to gain a greater appreciation for the history of this incredible music, which is really about a continuation of who we are as African people, as black people. And he has a new book out called No Half Steppin'. Would you please welcome to our microphones again the one and only Paradise Gray, co-founder of X-Clan. Brother Paradise Gray, how you be today?
Wonderful. Habaragani Elder.
Yeah, Yamoja Habaragani. All right.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and by the way, so delighted that you got your Legacy Award, because we really wanted to honor you for all the incredible work that you've done over the years. And, of course, we're trying to get our award to Chuck D as well and Sister Soldier. So we had awards going out to some of our real giants in the hip-hop field, and you were among them. So we were delighted to give you that honor.
Oh, thank you. And I am humbled and honored. That is one of the things I wanted to say is that I consider your generation the founding generation, the father and mother generation of hip hop, because we got hip hop from y'all. We got hip hop from James Brown, rest in peace. James Brown gave us that funk and that soul, and he put the beat on the one. And his songs from Funky Drummer on are the most sampled rhythms in the history of the world because of hip hop. So James Brown, George Clinton, Sly and the Family Stone, they passed the torch to us in hip hop, similar to the way that you have passed the torch to us with these legacy awards. And we honor our elders and ancestors.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Well, look, your first book is out. Again, it's called No Half Steppin', an oral and pictorial history of New York City Club, the Latin Quarter, and the birth of hip hop's golden era. What inspired you to do this book?
Well, 2016-2017 is the 30th anniversary of the Latin Quarter. And, you know, the book was 6 years in the making, but the timing was just perfect that it dropped right now, because now we're into the 30th anniversary, and it's time for that history to speak.
All right. Now, for some of us who don't know about the Latin Quarter, or some people who may not be as conversant as hip hop, tell us about the Latin Quarter.
Okay, the Latin Quarter started out in the early 20s in the Great White Way as the Cotton Club South. And all of the biggest stars in entertainment performed at the Latin Quarter, from the Rat Pack to Elvis Presley, and it was once owned by Barbara Walters' father, Lou Walters, and it was located on 48th Street between Broadway and 7th, which is now renamed Lou Walters Way. It also was a place where the Nicholas Brothers and all the great dancers went to dance, and unfortunately, it was one of those places that was extremely segregated, and black people was on stage, but they had to come in the back door. In the 80s, the club was reborn as a salsa club. And one day, hip-hop got an opportunity to make its mark there. And we came in around 1985, and we were able to reshape the history of music and entertainment.
Wow. That's a very, very powerful testimony there. So you say you were able to reshape it. Flesh that out a little bit. What began to happen in relationship to the Latin Quarter in that regard?
Okay, when we went into the Latin Quarter, the big stars in hip-hop was still Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Run DMC, the Fat Boys, Houdini, and LL Cool J was just making his emergence. We were able to incubate a whole new young generation and a new sound in hip-hop, and we transformed hip-hop shows into something where you would go and watch the show, into a place where you go and participated and you danced your butt off with a woman in hip hop, and that didn't happen very much before the Latin Quarter.
Mm. Okay,
we effectively incubated and grew artists that never had a shot to make it before. People like Biz Markie, Big Daddy Kane, Kool G Rap, Eric B and Rakim, Queen Latifah, MC Light, De La Soul, A Tribe Called Quest, Jungle Brothers, Ultra Magnetic, Public Enemy, Milk and Giz, Stetsasonic, and Just Ice, King's Son, and Nice and Smooth, and hundreds of other groups, including Heavy D and the Boys and X-Clan.
Right. So now you were promoting, I take it, just sort of scanning through the material. So you in these days were actually like, were you responsible for booking some of the groups or promoting some of the groups?
Sir.
What was your role?
I was responsible for booking the acts, hosting the shows, and basically being the walking concierge of hip hop.
Hmm. That's a pretty big title, brother. Walking concierge. Yep. All right. And that entailed, again, what we just talked about, just booking the acts and promoting them. And
yeah,
whatever.
Not just that, but if you needed help finding a producer or a promoter or what studio you should go in for what price, or basically whatever you needed in hip hop, I had you. You know, I connected people to each other. You know, and connected people to the early hip hop magazines and promotions. And if you went on stage at my club on a Friday and you rocked the spot on Monday morning, you had a record deal waiting for you.
And you called the book "No Half Stepping." Now, where did that title come? Well, what does that mean? What do you mean to convey
by
that title?
"No Half Stepping" comes from Heat Wave, a song that we used to rock back in the days. Ain't no half stepping. Well, that inspired. You remember that song?
Yeah, I do. Uh-huh.
Okay, well, that song is one of the, like I said, one of the foundation songs that we used to build hip-hop on. And Big Daddy Kane, who incubated at the Latin Quarter, that was one of his biggest hits at the Latin Quarter. And we felt like Big Daddy Kane as an artist and a person is indicative of the kind of skill level, the kind of performance, and the overall package. He was the package that we promoted at Latin Quarter, 100%. He had the look, he had the fashion, he had the style, he had the sound, and he could dance his butt off. He was the total package of lyricism and great beats. So we felt like his song would be the fitting title for the book.
Right, No Half Stepping. Now, tell us how the book is constructed. A lot of photos or histories. How did you go about producing the book, Ashley?
Well, the book is broken into chapters of some of the most interesting stories that happened at the club. But we basically formatted it like social media. It looks like it's like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram in a book.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. And so just share some of the highlights of some of the folk who are up in here. I'm looking at some of it here. I got
okay, there's an
on.
incredible photo of me and a young 19-year-old Mike Tyson. Great pictures of young Bobby Brown and Queen Latifah and MC Light, like at 19 years old. You know, great pictures of LL Cool J and DC, and you know, the Latin Quarter. It was incredible. It was a place where the street met the beat. You know, all the gangsters and entertainers were in the house. You know, not just from hip-hop, but the Cosby Kids hung out at the Latin Quarter every weekend. New Edition hung out there all the time. You know, and it wasn't anything special to see Sugar Ray Leonard or Marvin Hagler come walking in the door. You know what I'm saying? It was incredible. We had the original gangster, 50 Cent, not the rapper who appropriated his name, hanging out at the Latin Quarter with his crew of young gangsters from Fort Greene, Brooklyn, who unfortunately would come to Manhattan to snatch chains and hang out, you know. So it was athletes Giants and the New York Mets used to hang out at the Latin Quarter. It was just the mecca of entertainment because we had location, location, location. It was right in the middle of Times Square.
Right. And the book, I understand, has recently been reviewed by the New York Times Review of Books.
Yes, sir. The New York Times gave me like a whole page in the newspaper and gave us a great review of the book. I'm really happy about that. You know, that's an expensive review right there. If you paid somebody to get that review for you, you could pay anywhere between $10,000 and $20,000 just to get somebody to get that review.
And so the book is in hard copy, and is it also in you can also get it in other versions? You can get it in digital?
Right now it's a paperback, but the hard copy is coming next month, and it's available at Amazon.com and WaxPoetics.com.
Right. Now let me just tease out another here. I'm just looking at the title. It says The History of the New York City Club. And so that's all the same. The New York City Club, the Latin Quarter, that's the same club?
Well, you know, there's a lot of clubs around the world named the Latin Quarter.
I'm looking at the title itself. It says an oral and pictorial history of New York City Club.
Yes, we wanted to make sure that people knew that the Latin Quarter was the famous
I
New York
see.
City Club.
So this
year,
this is to make sure people know that it's the New York City Latin Club, because there are Latin clubs around the world.
Right.
Okay.
I went to I performed at the Latin Quarter in Detroit one time with X-Clan. It was funny. It wasn't just similar by name. We were waiting in our dressing room to perform, and we didn't get to perform that night because the opening act, somebody ran up on him with a baseball bat and hit him in the head with a bat while we were waiting to perform.
Oh, my goodness. There is that side.
Danger, you know what I mean?
Right, unfortunately, right. All right, the book is No Half-Stepping, An Oral and Pictorial History of the New York City, the Latin Quarter, and the Birth of Hip-Hop's Golden Era. Now, talk to me about this golden era question. Is this hip-hop's golden era?
I mean, nobody argues that, for real. You know, that, you know, from 86 to basically 92, you're not going to find record sales are higher now. But when it comes to establishing hip-hop worldwide, these are the artists that began to really be household names. And if you look, you still find it hard to find artists with bigger names than the artists from that era. MC Hammer, Queen Latifah, LL Cool J, Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. You know, they're still the top actors in the game now, even. You know what I'm saying? So that era was the era that really took hip-hop international, and that's the time when the major labels really came in and start signing artists to big, big, high-level deals.
Right. And in terms of the work that you do now, do you still have relationships with a lot of these artists? Are you still able to communicate with them, people like Queen Latifah and Big Daddy Kane and some of those folks?
It depends. If you notice, the book is not just me remembering what happened. We interviewed 65 of the artists and people from the club who were there. So Big Daddy Kane is in the book being quoted. So, yeah, I still maintain relationships with most of them.
Right. I got to say that many, many years ago, we were talking today about Kwanzaa in Youngstown. And my first remembrances of Queen Latifah was some of the young people who were working with us in Youngstown, Ohio, and they were talking about Queen Latifah, and I said, who is that, you know, and so forth. And of course she blew up big time, and I will never forget going to Harvard University. Professor Charles Ogletree had a program, and it was Queen Latifah, Fat Joe, and the brother from the business brother who he doesn't, you don't hear a lot of about him anymore, but he's from New Orleans. I'm blanking on his name now, but he's an entrepreneur.
Master P.
Master P, that's right. And it was a great session at Harvard. But I came away so impressed with Queen Latifah. I mean, she just was so impressive to me, her sensibilities, her thought process and everything, you know. And now she's, of course, done many, 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 many things, because I guess one of the mm-hmm. things that hip-hop has exposed is the incredible multi-talents of so many of these people now in film and theater, and not only. It's just an amazing tapping into the creative genius of Black people.
You just said what hip-hop really is as an art form. Hip-hop is, if you're a Star Trek fan, the musical Borg, hip-hop basically assimilates everything. Resistance is futile. You will be assimilated. We are the children of pop culture and soul and R&B. You know, we learn from the great masters, from Otis Redding and, you know, from the Motown experience. You know, we learn what to do and we learn what not to do. We've been ripped off, you know what I'm saying? We've been appropriated. We've been gentrified, you know, but at the same time, we've appropriated and we've taken everything that exists, and you will find it somewhere in hip-hop culture being exploited to the maximum.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. My head is churning now about ways in which we're going to give greater exposure to this in the greater New York area and some of the work that we do forthcoming. I want to change topics a little bit now. But I'm going to just repeat. The book is called No Half-Stepping, An Oral and Pictorial History of the New York City Club and the Latin Quarter and the Birth of Hip-Hop's Golden Era. And, of course, it is Brother Paradise Gray's first book. When I heard him, he was so excited. It's my first book, which sounds like there's some more books coming, and that's a good thing.
Oh, absolutely.
But, yeah, but
I got three being written right now.
Right. Well, that sounded good that you said you were so excited about your first book. And so we want people to go to Amazon and various other mediums in order to review it and hopefully to purchase it and to blow it up big time. The New York Times gave it a great review. And it's something that's really, really, really urgently needed, that exposure be given to people who are doing this positive and constructive work. Now, quickly, let's turn the page a little bit about the State of the Black World Conference. Unfortunately, you were not able to come, but I'm sure you've heard some of the report backs from the State of the Black World Conference. You've been a mentor to Jaziri X, who is just one of the most incredible young hip-hop activists. I call him a rap activist, if you will, out there today. So just give us your assessment and talk about maybe some of the things that we might be able to do moving forward.
Oh, man, I heard nothing back but incredible things, and a lot of people were able to connect very well. And also I heard that we started a document that we need to get together and finish editing. We got a lot of work ahead of us in these Trump years to come, you know what I mean? It's not about what they're going to do. What are we going to do?
Right.
You know? So, we definitely going to continue that great work that was started at the State of the Black World. We're going to be meeting. We're going to be meeting with business people. We're going to get financial literacy and grow our own food and lay our own rules in our streets. And definitely we're going to reach out to younger people and educate them in the way of our ancestors and do a much better job in our own community.
Right. Well, we're certainly looking forward to that. We really are trying to just live up to it. It was such an incredible experience, and we want to reconnect. We're trying to just position IBW as a facilitator, convener, resource center. That's what we are. We're not in a mass-based organization. We're not trying to control anything per se, but we are trying to bring us together, facilitate. And I'm really excited about this, the hip-hop track. You know, we cleared space for it. It was a little rocky, you know, trying to get it all together. But we really, really want to follow through, because I think this is at the cutting edge of what's possible. You know, this is at the cutting edge. I really think that what gets communicated by way of this medium is at the is one of the really cornerstones of what we have to do to reach young people and to reach all people, for that matter, to in this period But we've always needed that. And so I'm really, really eager to just sort of get in the middle of it and absorb it and to give whatever guidance I can in terms of direction as best I can as I listen and hear, because I absolutely believe that this is one of the key aspects that we have to have at the cultural front, you know, in terms of moving us forward in this period. And we thank you so much for the work that you have done, continue to do. Book number one is out. We're looking for book number two and three. And, of course, continuing this work around hip-hop.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. So we'll be in touch.
Peace and love.
All right. Paradise Gray, X-Clan, one of the co-founders. And by the way, X-Clan came out of the work of Sonny Abubadika Carson. You know, he was the mentor to them. And staunch and strong, and this group X-Clan, I first heard again out of Youngstown, Ohio, talking to young brothers and sisters there. Have you heard about X-Clan? Well, I was not into hip-hop, so I didn't know about Queen Latifah. I didn't know about X-Clan. I didn't know about any, but they were teaching me and telling me about them. And in my presidential campaign in 1992, when I ran for president of the United States, we brought X-Clan to Youngstown. To do a benefit fundraiser for me in my campaign, 1992, ancient history now. But because they were a cutting-edge group, I wanted somebody that was powerful, provocative, strong in that regard, because obviously we wanted to have that image, and they were in the cutting edge. And so Paradise Gray has continued, and we want people to go out and certainly support him, support this book, so that he can be supported and continue the work that he's doing. And again, as I said before, you know, the hip-hop track at the State of the Black World Conference was a very, 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 very powerful track. And so we want to reconnect with it and be in a position to actually continue it as we move forward in this period. It's going to take a lot of hard work to do that, but we absolutely want to do that. Those are our first three segments. Again, we've heard about the Kwanzaa Collective and its programming coming up. And again, we want to continue to talk about Kwanzaa because Kwanzaa is a part of it too. Those values, the seven values, the seven principles of the Black value system. And, you know, there are a lot of values, but these encapsulate in seven key principles how Black people, actually any set of human beings, really should live. But since we are suffering from white supremacy and capitalist exploitation and imperialism and all of those negatives, question is, what do we do as Black people? And these principles of unity, you know, unity, how do we build unity and principled unity, I might say, because, you know, it's not just skin color. It's not just uniting. There are a whole lot of Black folk, not a whole lot of Black people. There is a core group of Black people working with Trump. Well, I might end up having to deal with them in some way, but they're not me. I'm clear about that. Their skin color is not the basis of the unity. It's the content of the color, of their values, their principles, and their ideas or what I want to be united around. And so I have nothing in common with Clarence Thomas. I have nothing in common with some of these retrograde Black conservatives and reactionaries, if you will. They're not my kind. They're my color, but not my kind. So it's principled unity we have to be talking about. And the question of Kujichagulia, self-determination, the ability to name ourselves and define ourselves, that's critical. And to me, these next two are crucial. They are the cornerstones, really, of the African worldview. Ujima, not individual work, but collective work and responsibility. How do we work together as Black people? Because that's the way it was and is today. Even in traditional Africa, people work collectively, not just individually. And then the next one, Ujima. Cooperative economics, not capitalist economics. I mean, you might have a for-profit business, but how do we make our businesses benefit all of us? A cooperative set of principles. And then, of course, the custom NIA. You must have purpose in life, NIA. And if you're Black folks, under these conditions, you better know how to be creative. in a lot of ways, not only artistically, but how are you able to be innovative and creative in terms of how you do your work and how you engage struggle? And finally, Imani, faith. We say in the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, I say that much of what we do is based on guts and faith. Faith, guts and faith. The old black spiritual that says we've come this far by faith. The belief that we can do things that are beyond what we envision as our, not envision as our capacity, what we might initially think as our capacity, that we are greater than our sense of who we are, that we, if we can conceive it, we can achieve it. The faith, that principle of faith, that belief, that strong sense of what the possibilities are. It is Garvey saying, up you mighty race, accomplish what you will. It may be that faith and a spiritual power. It ought to be, but it is also a spiritual sense of possibilities. So those are those seven principles of the Black value system that guide Kwanzaa. And again, Kwanzaa is a way of deepening those within our lives. We're going to come back and we're going to take your calls. We're going to begin to have this as a critical part of our show. And of course, people have to line up a caller at a time, and we have to be patient with us as we get you in. But we hope you will call and to respond to what you've heard, or you may have questions that you want answered or information that you want to be shared with you. You can call 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818 is the number to call. Let me give it again. 347-335-0818. We're going to take a call, come back. I've got a few comments to make and take callers from our listening audience here on WBAI 99.5 FM, Pacifica Network, in collaboration with YC Radio. That's yourcollegeradio.org. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Spike Lee, and you are listening to WBAI Community Radio in New York City. WBAI exists almost entirely on your support. Please be generous. Thank you very much.
T-minus 10 seconds, counting.
What a sad situation.
Lift off.
2016.
It was the best of times.
2016 World Champions, Cleveland, Ohio.
It was the worst of times.
North Carolina is one of the top races to watch in this election.
Hey, everybody, get off the street. Get off the street.
Winter is coming.
The war is coming to an end.
Wherever we looked, the world was changing so fast that nothing of importance seemed to be happening.
Come with me.
The bus to the underworld.
Tune in for a shortcut.
2016.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
11 p.m. New Year's Eve, right here on WBAI FM.
Wait for the history.
And it's a little bit sad.
Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's not.
Hey there, friends. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Help us with our recovery. Go to WBAI.org and help us by joining the Buddy System. The more people we have on a recurrent basis giving money to the station, the less we'll have to have fund drives. Help us cut down on those and we'll do what we can for you. WBAI.org. Buddy. Make a difference.
You can live a healthy life and raise a healthy family in a toxic world if you know how. Hi, I'm Doug Wood, co-host of Green Street, the environmental health show here on WBAI. Every other Tuesday evening, Patty and I talk to some of the world's leading experts who provide in-depth information and practical solutions you can use to keep yourself and your family healthy and safe. So keep your radio set right here to 99.5 FM WBAI and join us every other Tuesday evening at 8 right here on Green Street.
All right, we're back, And really, really, I've enjoyed the show today, just in terms of the interviews that we've done. I really, really, really enjoy this. By the way, we want to continue to tell people to sign up. The pledge drive is over, but it's never over. Become a WBAI buddy. Very important. As I said before, you know, I'm a WBAI buddy. Last pledge drive, I always pledge myself. Sent my check in the other day. Hope it's been received. But I'm also a WBAI buddy. That's the basic thing for me, is to be a WBAI buddy. Then I contribute because I can. I can afford to. I'm not rich. I'm not wealthy. But I'm committed to supporting the causes that I believe in. And one of them, obviously, is WBAI as a strategic institution. So become a WBAI buddy. You can go to give to WBAI.org. Give to WBAI.org and sign up today to become a WBAI buddy. And I think you can dedicate it to Vantage Point as well. Quickly, just want to say that my columns, my articles and essays are called Vantage Point. That's why I've named the show Vantage Point, to keep the branding going. My most recent article is just out, just coming up for air, so that I've just written an extensive essay on the presidential election. It's my first opportunity to do so, to offer my opinions. It's the part first of a three-part series. This one is entitled Elections Matter. Trump will be Reagan on steroids. Let me repeat that. Elections matter. Trump will be Reagan on steroids. And that will appear on the WBAI website. If it's not up yet, it will be. So just go back and check it out during the course of the day. IBW21.org. That's IBW21.org. Secondly, I just want to comment on the United Nations vote, the U.S. abstaining on the resolution of the United Nations, which essentially condemned Israel for expanding settlements into the West Bank and in Jerusalem, if you will. And, of course, this has created consternation. Obama's being condemned. Democrats and Republicans are on his back about this. But I think it took an act of courage to stand up and say, you cannot do, and I will never forget having been on the same stage, one of the proud moments of my life, with former Prime Minister Michael Manley and Hanna Aswari, who is a representative of the PLO. What a really eloquent and powerful woman. And she said that these settlements are like creating facts on the ground, meaning that once they're done, it will nullify the possibility of a two-state solution. So to say to Israel as a friend and an ally that this is not what you ought to be doing, particularly when you're simultaneously sending off one of the largest military aid packages in recent history as a symbol of friendship, then I don't quite understand why the United States cannot join with almost the entire world, France, Britain, China, and saying, stop building the settlements, that it is, in fact, a complicating factor. And, in fact, it's designed to nullify the possibility of a two-state solution. And to the degree that the United States can take this position, it strengthens the United States as a good faith facilitator, which it has not been. It has really tilted decisively towards Israel in most instances. And, of course, there are, you know, organizations who are obviously pro-Israel, but also pro-two-state. This is not an issue where, you know, you're sort of out of step with all of the totality of the Jewish community if you take the position that, indeed, there ought to be a two-state solution and that these settlements are a problem. Anyway, that's just some comments I wanted to make before I go to our phones, 347-335-0818. I understand that we do have a caller, and let me welcome them, or that person. Welcome to, good morning, welcome to Vantage Point.
Hi, Ron, how you doing? Habargani.
It's Emoja Habargani.
Okay, Ron, I'm Doc Russell, one of your volunteers with Dana at the conference in Newark, a member of POP.
Okay.
And I'm really sorry I missed your follow-up program that you had for all the volunteers, because I had to go over on tour to Alabama. I'm back in New Jersey now.
Okay.
That conference was a powerful conference. I really enjoyed it. And I really networked with some of the people out of Atlanta that came there, Bobby, and the lawyer out of Selma.
Oh, yeah, attorney Fire Rose Teray.
Right, right.
Yeah.
While I was there, because I was in Alabama. But that conference was really powerful. A lot of good information came out of there, and I think we got a lot of positive people that's ready for what we need to do.
Well, we hope so, and we're going to be following up. And those of you who want to read about it, and we hope people will take time to read. I know sometimes, with this generation, particularly the millennial generation, it's what I call a short attention span deficit disorder. People want it quick, quick, quick. But some things you have to take time and read. There is a declaration of intent and call to action, which
right.
is on the website, that details what the blueprint is for the follow-up. And among them is to declare Newark as a African city. That doesn't mean, by the
Absolutely.
Way, that we're excluding other people, but it is a metaphor, really, for suggesting that we really, really want to aggregate resources to support Mayor Roz J. Baraka in this effort to make this city an example. It is a predominantly black city, and it is how, even in a predominantly black city, all people can live in harmony, justice, and peace, but in prosperity as well, in
Absolutely.
Justice and dignity. So we thank you for attending and participating, and we will be following up. So don't worry about that. We're going to be working.
Okay, I'm out of Hackensack, but I spend a lot of time in Newark when I'm
right,
in
okay.
town.
Well, go to the website, and also we need people to also respond to our appeal, because we talked about
okay.
our capacity. So we're hoping people will respond to the appeal that we're having for support so that we can be strong
it.
Enough to come back to Newark in 2018. That's the goal. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
And thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Okay. Others can call. It'll take a second or two for you to connect, if you will. But we now have a open line for you to call, 347-335-018. That's 347-335-018 on this first night of, or first day of Kwanzaa, if you will. Again, I want to establish this section of the program always to give people an opportunity to call in, to ask questions, criticisms, observations, comments, anything you want to do along those lines. Sometimes I may restrict it to a particular line of questions or line of inquiry, but today it is open line, if you will, in order to, no pun intended, because there is a popular program called Open Line that I respect a great deal. It's an opportunity for you to call in, 347-335-0818. I will continue to reiterate that my most recent essay, which is entitled, again, Elections Matter, Trump will be Reagan on steroids. Trump will be Reagan on steroids. And so I made that remark at a conference with Barbara Arnwine, and it got quite a applause, if you will. And so I decided to write an essay about it. It's comprehensive, I think, and we hope that you'll enjoy reading it, and we hope that people will debate it, discuss it. I'm sure not everybody's going to agree with it, but we don't have to always agree. The main thing is it be in a spirit of civil discussion with each other, particularly those among us who are progressives, liberals, revolutionaries. Let's have the debate. Let's have the conversation about how we move forward, what we did right, what we did wrong, and how can we move in a direction, moving forward. So let's go to our next caller. Good morning. Welcome to Vantage Point.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling in regard to what I just heard on the air, and I just can't believe my ears. You're going to declare a city a black city? How about if somebody wants to declare a city a white city? Come on. That's what I don't like about WBAI. It's very racist, and you're not aware of your racism. Thank you. You ain't the new generation for me, that's for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad you're listening. That's at least you're listening. So if you know what WBAI is not, because you're listening. Now, what I said was, yes, we want to use the language. We want to declare Newark a model African city, because it is a predominantly black city. I also went on to say that in so doing does not mean that it will be oppressive or be exclusive or in any way discriminatory towards others, because that's not who we should be as black people. That's not what our history is. That's not going all the way back to ancient Kemet. The whole notion of righteousness and justice is always what we ought to be about. So even if we are in control, we should not exclude and we should not discriminate. We should include and treat all people justly. That is what black should mean. It should epitomize justice and righteousness. So as a people who have been exploited by white supremacy historically, we think we have a right to assert affirmatively in the name of Kujichagulia, which is the second principle of Kwanzaa, that we can, yes, if the city is a predominantly black city, say that it is a model black city, a model African city. But in so doing, it does not mean excluding others. And in fact, there is no history among black people doing that historically. The main thrust of black history, the main thrust of the black freedom struggle has always been inclusive. It has always been, in fact, to move in a way that the benefits that have accrued out of the struggle of black people have contributed to the liberation of all people. That is who we are. That will continue, even as we use that language. So I hope that explains it. It probably won't be satisfying, but that's the nature of the proposition. We have another caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was calling to find out the number for the December 28th, the Kwanzaa Festival at Macon Street. I heard it on your show earlier.
Yeah, he said that it would be up on the website later.
For Wednesday.
Yeah, he didn't really give a phone number per se. And
yes,
actually, I didn't write down the website. I think it was International African Arts Festival.
Mm-hmm.
If you Google International African Arts Festival, that website will come up, and the date for it will be on that website, he said, later today.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you
so much for listening.
Okay. Bye, dear.
Oh, goodbye. All right. 347-335-0818. We have room for others to call. We have a few more minutes. 347-335-0818. We'll get you into the conversation, questions, comment, or a critique. One of the callers critiqued. He called to say he was astounded that we would call Newark a model black city, and that he was offended by that. And he has every right to call and offer his perspective, and we will respond in kind. But, you know, it's not, you won't be cut off because you disagree. That's for sure. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning, Ron. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Ron, I just wanted to ask you, do you think that Obama will...
Hello? It sounds like we lost that.
We lost the caller.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, others can call. Maybe he'll call back. Again, the number to call is 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. We'll get you into the conversation. President Obama did pardon some more people. There's a fervent desire that he will pardon hundreds, if not thousands more, before the orange man comes to power, before Trump, because a lot of this is going to be turned back. Obama is moving to try to cement some things in place that hopefully cannot be undone. But, you know, much of what he has done will be undone, or there's an effort to try to undo it. Many of us are hoping that he will pardon the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, is one of his legacy acts. I'm really, really praying that that will happen. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you, Ron?
Good.
Good. In addition to pardoning Marcus Garvey, we hope he pardons Mumia, Leonard Peltier, and Oscar Lopez.
Sure.
Yes. I'm calling to respond to that other white caller that called. I am also a what we call white person. And I just want to say that that's, I don't know, it's kind of a very touchy issue, but I really want to say that I am a white person who very much is involved in the black community. I was actually at your Black World Conference.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a mostly African-American Caribbean neighborhood. I teach in schools that are similar. And I have always felt very welcomed. I have always felt extremely surrounded in welcomeness and love by the African-American Caribbean community. And I am grateful for you and what you're doing. And I really personally feel that you guys, meaning people that are of color, who have been oppressed, and others, indigenous people, are the leaders for the future. And I humble myself to you. And there is, however, an issue around we people of, European white skin needing to also heal themselves. So I want to say that to this caller, that if he can look into whatever it is that's bringing up that fear or sadness or anger, whatever it is that brought up for him when he heard you say those words, that would be the path to his growth and development. I went to the conference and I felt a little uneasy sometimes being one of the only white people there. And I thought to myself, you know what, I really need to work on my own healing more and my people. So I found out that there's a conference for people who, it's called a privilege conference, that will be in the spring for white people, and looking, examining privilege and how we can use it to help the world and how we use it to hurt. So I just want to comment on that and just say I love what you're doing. I support everything you're doing, and power to the people.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate that. Really appreciate that. And I understand the caller, frankly, and I think it is important to try to understand. Because on the surface of it, it sounds like, well, wait a minute. You say you don't want to be discriminated against. Why are you then saying black people? Well, I'm saying it out of a context, out of a historical context. If you understand the historical context out of which it's being said, then it would not be offensive. But if you don't deal with that historical context, or you're in denial about it or want to avoid it, then it becomes difficult, you know. And there are times when I'm glad that the previous caller had a great experience. There were times in the 60s, had she come to the conference, where she would not necessarily have had a good experience, where it might have been rough because black people were feeling, look, we need space to ourselves. We need time to ourselves. And there were times when actually white people were asked to leave meetings, not because they were necessarily anti-white, but it was a demand that we have a space to ourselves, if you will. And that was a period that we went through, and that we're not in that space now. But on the other hand, you know, it was important, and some people felt betrayed by that, and a lot of anger came out of that as well. But nonetheless, that was a part of an experience that we went through, and that we had a right to go through. Native Americans have done likewise. Latinos have done likewise. I have no, you know, I mean, I think people have to have their spaces, if you will, as a part of this broad effort. And then it's on us internally to have what I call in-group identification, out-group association. So that's kind of, you know, how it goes. And I'm glad there are going to be these conferences where people can discuss privilege, can discuss how white people can play a role and need to play a role. Because quite frankly, as Malcolm regretted that he had once told a white person that there was no role for him to play, for them to play, he said, I made a mistake. There is a role. And that role is trying to interact really with white people more to get them to understand the nature of privilege, if you will. And there was this experiment done many, many years ago, this book called It's Black Like Me, I think it was called, by a guy named Howard Griffith, if I recall correctly, in which he injected himself and changed his skin color. And then he went through the world as a black person, and all of a sudden he understood what it meant. Anyway, it's time for me to get out of here. Have really enjoyed the show today. Enjoyed you, your calls, and the debate and discussion. We want to have plenty of that. Again, go to the website, IBW21.org, IBW21.org, to support IBW and to get the Declaration of Intent and call to action, all those good things. And don't forget to become a WBAI buddy. Go to the website, give to WBAI.org right now to become a WBAI buddy. We'll see you again next week here on Vantage Point.
Well, Jesus was a homeless lad with an unwed mother and an absent dad. And I really don't think he would have gotten that far if Newt, Pat, and Jesse had followed that star. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Oh, when Jesus taught the people he would never charge a tuition fee. He just took some fishes and some bread and served up free school lunches instead. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Oh, he healed the blind and made them see. He brought the lame to their feet. Yeah, rich and poor, anytime, anywhere, just pioneering that free health care. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Well, now Jesus hung with the low-life crowd, but those working stiffs sure did him proud. Yeah, some were murderers, thieves, and whores, but at least they didn't do it as legislators. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. Well, now Jesus lived in troubled times. The religious right was on the rise. Oh, now what could have saved him from his terrible fate? Separation of church and state. So let's all sing out praises to that long-haired radical socialist Jew. You know, sometimes I fall into deep despair when I hear all those hypocrites on the air. Oh, but every Sunday gives me hope when pastor, deacon, priest, and pope are all singing out their praises to some long-haired radical socialist Jew. They're all singing out their praises to
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights 99.5 WBAI.
People are already comparing the upcoming Trump era to the 50s McCarthy era. On the next episode of Ken Gayle's Ecologic will be a discussion with people who were there. The 50s had the communist blacklist and attack on unions, but it also had Ban the Bomb and civil rights marches and the flourishing of political folk music. Join Corinne Willinger of the Raging Grannies, Viney Burroughs of the Granny Peace Brigade, and other elders who lived through the McCarthy era. Tuesday, January 3rd at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.